At Sixes and Sevens, we'd like to welcome today Dr. William Shire. Dr. Shire is the owner and practitioner in advanced family dentistry of Cape Cod. But today we're going to talk about the next level of his practice, which is the Snoring and Sleep Apnea Treatment Center. Now, why do we want to talk to Dr. Shire about snoring and sleep apnea? Because it's particularly an issue for people between 60 and 80. That doesn't mean that there's no problem that shows up earlier, but it is an issue of people not really admitting what an issue it is, what a problem it can be. And admitting usually takes place after 60 for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Shire is going to tell us about the issues, and he's going to describe some of his treatment approaches. But mostly he's going to try to persuade and motivate people to not treat snoring and sleep apnea as though it's unimportant. It's very important. Dr. Shire, tell us why it's important.
Well, I think those are all real good questions. And to begin with, I'd like to maybe step back for a second and again state that I am a general dentist, and that any general dentist could be aware of what we're about to talk about. Personally, I took a lot of my training with the Jesuits, and the Jesuits have a pillar of their church that's called cura personalis, which is the care for the entire person, as opposed to just a dental approach. And so what it suggests is looking at the patient as a whole, as well as just in their mouth, so that basically boils down to a respect for the person in their entirety, their needs and their wants, as well as how they feel about what they want. So given that, I've always tried to model my practice around having a more medically oriented dental practice than you would say might be average. Relative to the snoring and sleep apnea portion of it, it's a huge area of concern today, that we know that in the United States, there, if we go on what most of a range of percentages that we hear from either the National Sleep Foundation, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, the American Academy of Dental Sleep Medicine, we know that there are somewhere in between one out of every four and one out of every five adults in the United States has some form of sleep disordered breathing. And that, you know, with 300 million people in the country, that's quite a number of people who are mostly undiagnosed. 90% of people who have it, it's estimated, are undiagnosed. And I think part of that is the identification, and part of that is the admittance that you have a potential issue. So who better to evaluate the snoring based on what happens in a person's throat and mouth but a dentist? Number one, we see their patients more frequently than they see their physicians. Right. We have a better feel for what the oral cavity is supposed to look like if you're properly trained. And in our case, we have a screening test that can be administered in 5 minutes to determine whether a patient's at risk or not. And this screening test has to do with clinical exam, a questionnaire, a sleepiness questionnaire, an Epworth sleepiness questionnaire, as well as some other examination of medical history, comorbidities such as high blood pressure, heart conditions, diabetes, again, impotence, depression. All of these things can have as a contributing factor sleep apnea. But my point is to get a patient screened and then tested, and then treated. are basically the three steps that we'd like, you know, to perform. And again, who better to do that than dentists?
Tell me this, have most people who come into your treatment center, have most people had these problems for many, many years and just ignored them? And it's hard to imagine that people could ignore it, because sleep occurs every night or part of every day. But people just live with it and live with it, and then all of a sudden will be open to you saying something. What causes people to suddenly say, tell me why I snore, for example?
Oh boy, that really hits at the heart of it. And it's again back to the admittance thing. I mean, it's a myriad of approaches, but for instance, we have people say, my wife told me to come here because I snore too much and I can't sleep in the same room, or my husband. So it sometimes approaches that. A lot of times in dentistry, especially, and I've learned this in my 25 years of practice, first you have to tell someone something, then you have to tell them what you told them, and then you have to tell them what you told them that you told them before they start to have some sort of, I guess, agreement toward it. Now, unfortunately, in a case of sleep apnea, or even in a case of a tooth, if you don't treat it, it a lot of times gets worse. And with sleep apnea, what I think we've shown in our screening and explained very succinctly in our screening is that this is a continuum of things. Starts with mild snoring that has no symptoms. Then it goes to perhaps snoring with some symptoms, such as upper respiratory resistance syndrome, sleepiness.
What is that, short of breath?
Well, that's further along, certainly.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and then sleep apnea, which is apneic events where people are tired or have other comorbidities, high blood pressure again, any heart conditions, obesity, certainly, all of these things. And the continuum, unfortunately, ends at death by asphyxiation. I mean, so it's not something that's a social nuisance anymore, snoring. We've realized that. And it's not everyone that snores has sleep apnea, certainly, but there are certainly other clinical signs that go along with that and medical history signs that go along with that. And the only way to tell if you have it or not is to have a sleep test.
Well, let's step back for a minute, because maybe some of our listeners don't, as you say, hearing the problem is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe people don't know the connections among snoring, insomnia, and sleep apnea.
Okay.
That may not be a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
It may be some other kind of shape.
Right.
But can you, for our listeners, tell us what those things are and how they differ from one another?
And the study of sleep is just so fascinating.
Mm.
To the question of insomnia versus sleep apnea, these are two of several different sleep disturbances. Insomnia is the inability to begin, maintain, and have a high quality of sleep.
So that's insomnia.
That's insomnia, and it could be from psychogenetic origin. It could be from medications. It could be from behavioral problems.
Like leaving the TV on,
or, you know, ever
somebody
since,
else up in the house and chatting.
I mean, ever since the Thomas Edison invented the incandescent light bulb, our circadian rhythm has gone into a free fall. And I mean, we're terrible sleepers. Our children are awakened at the worst possible time we could awaken them for memory consolidation and restful sleep, etc. We just are terrible at all of that. But as far as sleep apnea versus insomnia, sleep apnea is a different category of sleep disturbance. It's a sleep disordered breathing. It has to do with how the air goes into your body and gets to the blood, so the oxygenated blood can go to the brain.
So it's not sensory the way insomnia is?
Not obstructive sleep apnea, central sleep apnea, which is tied more closely to the neurological disturbance, which is probably about maybe I think I want to say 5 to 10% of the apneics, but the type that I'm treating, and so central sleep apnea cannot be controlled by what I do. That is controlled by other methods. But obstructive sleep apnea, which is an obstruction or a blockage of the airway, is what we treat. So back to the question, the result is the same.
The result is
the same for when you're in your waking hours, which you are, you know, irritable, moody, tired, downright mean sometimes, because you're not properly sleeping. So the results are the same, but they are actually two different, completely different categories, insomnia and sleep apnea.
And your suggestion is essentially that people should ask, if they're having any of these problems, they should ask the dentist.
Well, that's a bit of a loaded question. I would say it's the other way around. The dentist should be the ones that are, as any healthcare professional, should be much more aware of it. Nurses, dentists, physicians, let's face it, physicians don't have the time to spend with the patients because of the way our medical insurance and model is set, unfortunately, right now. It's more quantity than quality in a lot of times, but there's nowhere near enough emphasis placed on this. But so my answer to your question is the dentists should be the ones that are screening these out. And it's very simple as part of a review of health history. I mean, you can see the 100-pound overweight male with a 22-inch neck come in, and you know that he is, you know, fits the mold. Not that that's always the case, but we've been fooled often. But I would suggest, yeah, that people be more aware of it, but the dentist should be, the physician should be as well. And that's been part of this now going on 4-year focus that I've placed on this, is educating the general population as well as other dentists as well as physicians. And that's why I'm so thankful to be able to have this talk, so that the word can get out. And believe me, the problem is so prevalent that not just my little office in Orleans can handle all the apneics on Cape Cod. We have people coming from Upper Cape, Lower Cape, Mid Cape, and that's because I'm tied in with some of the physicians relative to, they know that I do this, and they know which patient that, because I've educated them, they know which patients this applies to as opposed to what they're treating or how they're treating. And the goal is to have better medical outcomes.
Right. You brought a device to help explain what you do. If someone came into your office and said, I had my yearly physical and I was told that I should consult you because I'm having some serious, or even moderate, doesn't have to be serious. Show us what you've got.
Yeah, sure. So we have certainly an educational tool, again, to be able to show people exactly what their particular case, again, treating the individual, because every person is different. Mm-hmm. Every situation is different. And there are maybe, I would say, 20 to 30 different appliances. And now I hate to use the word appliance because everybody thinks of their refrigerator or their stove. But when dentists use words all the time that are kind of really scary or probably ridiculous sounding words to a lay person, but the appliances are devices, if you will call them, are custom made mouth guard like devices that a patient would put in their mouth at night to reposition their jaw slightly forward and slightly open.
Slightly forward on the lower side.
Slightly forward on the lower, and slightly open, to be able to open the airway to allow them to breathe properly.
Oh, well, that actually makes sense, because in meditative healing breathing, in prayer, in other situations, one is always encouraged for deep breathing, healthful breathing, to breathe in through the nose and out through the mouth. Mm-hmm. And in order to breathe fully out through the mouth, one has to.
Right.
I mean, really let the jaw drop.
And that's what we're trying to promote, exactly.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're trying to promote nasal breathing. Think of a lot of people know CPR.
Right.
Well, what's the first thing we do when we do CPR is ABCs in CPR is A is open the airway by tilting the head back and pulling the chin forward. The head tilt, chin lift maneuver in
like
CPR.
This?
And yes,
yeah.
And that's what that's how you open your that's how you open a patient's
a victim's
airway, if you will. Yeah. So that's what these do, and so this is a model of how one would be made of one, and it actually fits on either arch, and they both go in at the same time. Then it has an adjustment, and it actually brings the jaw forward as we adjust it again for each individual. So how we determine that is by means of X-rays of the patient's jaw, as well as me from experience knowing where their jaw has to be to open their airway, and it's they're custom made, adjustable, and there are ways to manufacture them and then test them for efficacy.
And how easy are they to get in and out? Are they a big problem?
Very simple.
Very simple.
Yeah, we find that these are much more tolerable than a lot of the current treatments are what's called a CPAP. A CPAP machine is, in the past, has been considered the frontline treatment for sleep apnea, which is basically a machine that has a mask that covers a lot of times the nose and mouth, and sometimes just cannulae that go into the nose that shoot air through the constricted airway by means of forcing it through. So it's basically shot in at a high rate of speed, said something like 20 miles an hour, to get the air into your lungs to allow you to have oxygen in your blood.
That means there's a lot of activity at the back of the mouth and throat and over the back of the tongue. There's a lot of sensation associated with CPAP.
There is. There are a lot of reasons that people... As a matter of fact, 50% of the people prescribed CPAP do not tolerate it because of the side effects of claustrophobia, because of the side effects of drying out of the throat tissue, the noise, the hose that wraps around, the appearance of it, the importability, if you will, of it, not being able to travel with it.
Yeah, you have to take it in a bag.
You would have to take it. Yeah, you would have to take it through. You know, when you're traveling, whereas as opposed to the appliances, it's completely a different thing. So, you know, the CPAP does have its, if people can use it, I encourage people to use it. They don't have to wear a dental appliance. As long as they're getting the treatment and it's effective, then that's what is good for them. I've had several people who tell me, I wear my CPAP, I just want the appliance to travel, then I'll make them the appliance to travel. But the people that can't tolerate the CPAP are the ones that we do a lot of this appliance for to help.
We'll take a break for just a moment, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
Dr. Shire, can you tell our audience what... sleep apnea is, what happens and how often it happens and what the consequences are?
Sure. So sleep apnea is diagnosed by a sleep study, whether it's an at-home sleep study, which we can order and have shipped to the patient's home, and so they can hook up a couple of wires to themselves and record what happens. Or the patient could go to a sleep lab. There are a couple in Hyannis, I believe, sleep diagnostics in one other, and then there is one in Falmouth. And what these studies do are to count the number of times a patient snores or stops breathing. So snoring is the partial closure of the patient's airway, if you will. Think of it that way. So that's the noise that snoring makes, is because the airway is starting to collapse on itself. When it becomes fully collapsed on itself and the air cannot pass through there, it's called an apnea. But it's only recorded as an apneic event if the person stops breathing for a period of 10 seconds. That equals one apneic event. Mild to moderate sleep apnea the person does that between 5 and 15 to 20 times in an hour's time. More severe apnea would be greater than 30 or upwards of 50 times in an hour that the patient stops breathing for one full minute, and that's the definition of an apnea. There are also other other factors that are watched in a sleep study, whether you're partially breathing, whether you have arousals, whether your blood oxygen goes up or down. All of those things are recorded in a sleep study. But the apneic event itself is the cessation of breathing for 10 seconds or more.
And the consequences of an apneic event is that the required optimal amount of oxygen in circulation is reduced.
Correct. Not only that, your sleep is interrupted. Your REM sleep would be interrupted as well. And the oxygen level of your blood, which is recorded during the sleep study, dips down below, as you said, the optimum level. And so you don't have oxygenated blood. You don't have oxygen to your brain. That's sufficient. Thus, the more tired sleep.
And to other organs as well.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. So everything isn't functioning.
That's right.
And so everything depends.
Sleep is so important.
Yes. Joseph Pilates, the exercise guru, said that breathing is so fundamental. It's the first act of life and the last act of life.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think about when you think about sleep disorder and the treatment of sleep disorders?
So I thought it would be nice, because I know you're a patron of the arts, that I would bring a quote from Don Quixote, who said, "And bless the man who invented sleep, a cloak to cover over all human thought, food that drives away hunger, water that banishes thirst, fire that heats up the cold, and chill that moderates passion, and finally, the universal currency from which all things can be bought. The weight and balance that brings the shepherd and the king, the fool and the wise to the same level."
So. Why is it so important to get the proper sleep? Not just the amount of sleep, but the proper sleep. I ask you this because it seems to me that even if somebody says, "Can you help me, Dr. Shire, with my issue or my problem," you're still dealing with people who don't make it easy for you. Mm-hmm. They're not believing you, really. Mm-hmm. So what do you tell them? Why is healthful sleep so important?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that the quality of the sleep impacts the systemic health in a manner that people wouldn't necessarily see the result of without trying it, without having something to compare to. I just recently read an article in a Men's Health magazine that said less than 6 hours of sleep a night, which I think more than a third of the country does, is the equivalent of smoking a pack of cigarettes a day from a health standpoint. The insidious nature of what low oxygenated blood and tiredness, if you will, improper sleep, the insidious nature of what it does to your other organs of your body, heart musculature, again, high blood pressure results from it, diabetes. It's not something that there's a cause and effect that people can see very easily.
No, you can't see what all the effects are.
Right.
And you couldn't possibly, unless you really study anatomy, you can't even imagine it.
Right.
And yet people come to you and you can't give them a short course on all that, but you have to be able to persuade them, don't you?
Correct. And that's why my staff has been properly educated, and they know my passion for this. They have the same passion, not necessarily all the same training. Some of them have more advanced than others because we're a 6-8 person office. But the point is, we have a presentation, if you will. And what I think the most important thing is, we have a presentation for the patients to see what it could do, and we can give them the data. We can tell them what it does. But until they see how important it seems to me.
Right, you personally.
Me personally.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I have in mind the care of the entire person for them, and they should know that because they can read my mission statement and understand that I'm in it for their care. And that's what brings me to work every day. And when they see how important it sounds to me or seems to me, 90% of the time I can get them to understand and be at least tested. So, and again, it's the same thing. I have to tell them, then I have to tell them what I told them, and then I have to tell them what I told them that I told them. And it sometimes takes a year of three intervals of visit for, you know, their regular checkup visits before they say, okay. And I've even been known to get down on my knees and beg, actually.
And beg, so, in serious cases.
Yeah, yeah. Because there is the end game. The end game is if it's untreated, and it's not a joke, it has happened, people can die from it. Right. And not only that, they can live a less quality of life and not be able to see their grandchildren and or be active with their grandchildren and children and so on. So,
yeah, and, I think and the proper breathing during sleep, and also a lengthy sleep, mm-hmm. a productive sleep, mm-hmm. leads to longevity.
Correct.
Right? Not just energy in day-to-day life, but mm-hmm. longevity may improve yeah. lifespan by 5-10 years.
I mean, I don't know if there's any correlative data that we could discuss on that, but certainly we know what happens when we don't sleep well. I mean, there are obviously much more problems, whether they're medical or psychological or psychosocial, accident, industrial accident level things. And so, I think it's quite apparent. It's just not, attention hasn't been paid to it as much as it needs to be for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And would you say that you encounter more resistance from men versus women? Or does the problem show up more in men versus women?
I think the prevalence of sleep apnea in men is higher. I don't think I know it is. Again, I'm not sure the exact percentages. And just the fact that men seem to be easier in denial than
to
women.
To be more in denial.
To find it easier and are not quite as in touch with their body's feelings as women are, just in general, I would say.
So it's very, very important that men in particular come mm-hmm. to you because you can persuade them from a number of points of view.
It's true. It's true. And but I don't give up. If I know someone needs to be tested and they refuse, I certainly document it in my chart, because then I tell them I'm documenting this in this chart because I don't want your attorney to come after me because we didn't ask you to be tested because you should be tested. And I usually get a response after one or two tries with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I have to lay all the cards out on the table.
Right, right. And that's what a professional is required to do. I mean, there's no criticism, there's no undermining of a person's confidence or so on. In fact, it seems to me that when you talk to patients who have these issues or troubles, you're actually attempting to improve their confidence. I mean, One would hope.
Yeah, one would hope, yeah.
Well, that's the whole thrust of At Sixes and Sevens. There's so much attention and media about the problems of aging and being 60 to 80. And from the first time I met you and knew about your initiative in your practice, I thought, people need to hear. It's not an impediment to have an issue or a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Find the right person. Find Dr. William Shire and ask him, what do I need to do? And then trust. And it seems to me, you've shown us your appliances, it's not so complicated.
No, that's the beauty of it. If it's
yeah.
It's really not that complicated. And it's actually easier than doing dentistry. For me,
in terms of
much easier. So, but it, and the results are more rewarding. I mean, I've had people tell me I've changed their lives. I mean, I can say probably more than 40% of the people we've treated for the sleep apnea are just, you know, want to give me a big hug. And it's very rewarding. I mean, not that dentistry itself isn't rewarding as well, but, you know, this is just something that I want to write off into the 60s and 70s and 80s on.
For yourself.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing all our audience at Sixes and Sevens into your practice, into your way of thinking about what you offer your patients, and also for the, I guess, the inspiration that one doesn't have to live with problems that are correctable, and you can help people have a better quality of life and live longer. Mm-hmm. That's quite a proposal.
That's great, and that's well put. And thank you for putting it that way, as well as for the opportunity to continue along with my mission of trying to educate enough people to be able to help more people and to have people realize that this is an important thing and it's going to improve their quality of life and extend their lives. And in some cases, save their life.
Perhaps we'll talk again. I hope so.
Great. We'll look forward to it.
Bye-bye.